Last Thursday, Russia's president held his annual mega press conference, and we bring you the second half of that 3-hour and 45-minute sit-down with Vladimir Putin.
I think Ukraine is not far from Russia as well, so let's take a question from Ukraine now.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. Well, Ukraine is far away from Bashkortostan. We only we are only acquainted with Burat. So you don't always reply to all of my questions. So you didn't hide the fact that you were sending some of the servicemen to Donbass, and what we mean is that they kill Ukrainian citizens. We know what we have to do with them. Some are killed, but some get jailed in Ukraine. Some are taken prisoners. Well, do you want to swap your citizens? And it's not that difficult, because Ukrainians don't leave their men behind. We want to get back our 65 people. And it's not just Mr. Sentsov, there's dozens of Crimean Tatars. If you win the election, perhaps, in case, will you continue to pursue this absurd policy on the so-called peacekeepers? No, those who are there, appointed by you, they are conducting a massacre. You know, you might remember Slavyansk and Mariupol. You know, they've been liberated by the Ukrainian army and they live a free and flourishing life.
Let's take another question.
Елена Глушакова, РИА Новости. I have a question. Ukraine. What about the Minsk agreements? It seems that we are all too far away from resolving the situation. Can they still be used? We also have systemic regular meetings between U.S. and Russian officials on Ukraine. Could they become the fifth member of the Normandy Four? And I have a question on Ukrainian politician Mr. Saakashvili. What is his future role in Ukraine, and what are the prospects for Ukraine in general? As for the Minsk agreements, indeed, it has demonstrated low efficiency due to, first and foremost, unconstructive position of the current Kyiv authorities. They don't have any desire to implement those agreements. They don't want to launch a real, full-fledged political process. And again, the ultimate goal is to have a law on the special status of Donbass. And again, there's been a law that was approved by the parliament on the special status, but it's not been enforced due to a number of reasons. So there was an agreement on that particular law. We know the provisions of the law. As for the U.S., the U.S. is a full-fledged member of the resolution process, regardless of whether they are part of the Normandy 4 format or not. They are deeply engaged. Anyway, they have a lot of information. Do we need to formally incorporate them into that format? Well, I've never opposed that decision, but it's not up to us to agree on not on that. Now, I'd like to reply to the voice that you raised. Well, you speak Russian fluently, and so it means that mentally wise, Bashkortostan is not that far away from Ukraine, if you don't take the geographic principle. As for the tragedy in Ukraine, now that's a tragedy. I agree with you, fully agree with you. But again, what has been the reason for it? That was the coup d'etat, the unconstitutional takeover of power, an armed one. And some part of Ukraine disagreed with it and they opposed it. Ukraine said it wanted to move towards Europe, but the authorities started to use special services and then they launched a full-blown army operation. There are no Russian army troops there, but there are militia groups that are self-sufficient and are ready to counter any major offensives against Donbass. We believe that this fully meets the interests of the people who reside on those territories. Why? Because if they don't have this opportunity, the massacre that you just raised, it will be worse than in the Srebrenica massacre. And that will be conducted by the so-called nationalist battalions, Ukrainian nationalist battalions. Nothing would stop it. Some of the Europeans recommended me to turn to international human rights groups, but you know, those nationalist battalions won't be stopped by those international human rights groups. As for the peacekeepers, well, Mr. Poroshenko talked about the need to arm OSCE officials. I agreed with it immediately, but the OSCE said no. The OSCE said they don't have this experience, they don't have the stuff, and they don't want to give weapons, they don't want to give arms to their officials because they would be the victim, they would become the targets for both sides. Then Mr. Poroshenko said that the UN forces should protect the security of the OSCE officials. I agreed with that, and we even submitted a draft resolution there, saying that there would be UN official, UN troops to secure OSCE officials. And then I had a telephone conversation with Ms. Merkel, who said that the OSCE officials move around Donbass and there shouldn't be just UN troops on the disengagement line. And she asked me to agree to the deployment of UN troops on the border of Ukraine and Russia. And I thought about that, and I told her, yes, I agree. And we adjusted our UN Security Council resolution. And now it turns out it's not enough still. That basically, they just want to keep that territory under international control. We don't have anything against that, but it's up to the Kyiv authorities. The Kyiv authorities should agree with the leaders of those territories. And again, no international mediation in the world history has been able to resolve those issues. Direct contacts are needed, but the Kyiv authorities have been trying to avoid them. As for swaps of prisoners, exchange of prisoners, I agree that people have suffered a lot and there are many innocent people. Do you really feel that that's done on the initiative of Donbass? They just were shelled recently, just yesterday, shelled by the Ukrainian army. Or was it not the army, but some nationalist battalions? We don't know who shelled Donbass yesterday. And there's not always good relations between the nationalist battalions and the regular Ukrainian army. But, you know, true officers, they have the ultimate goal to protect their nation from an outer threat, from external threat. They shouldn't be engaged in some domestic conflict. As for the exchange of prisoners, Mr. Medvedchuk is in charge of it, instructed by Mr. Poroshenko. So he was invited to a monastery, and he was asked to use his leverage with the leadership of the two unrecognized republics, the Lugansk and Donetsk republics, so that they agree to that exchange. So we had that conversation, and then Mr. Medvedchuk, after the consultations with Kiev, gave a list of 67 people on one side and 300 plus on the other side. This was the list provided by the Ukrainians, and they all agreed to it, so that's how it was. But then they said, no, it's bad, we need to modify that list. And they froze everything once again. Okay, let's do it. Just let's do it. We can take the next step later on. Christmas coming, New Year is coming. Let's do this goodwill gesture. Let's make this goodwill gesture. Now on Saakashvili, what Mr. Saakashvili has been doing is spitting in the face of the Georgian nation and spitting in the face of the Ukrainian nation. He was a person who was a president of an independent state. And now he's running around some squares and saying, I'm a Ukrainian. Saakashvili's been shouting he's Ukrainian. Does Ukraine not have true, authentic Ukrainians? And Ukraine has been, you know, putting up with it. You know, it's so pathetic. My heart's bleeding when I'm looking at it. How far or close we are. You might disagree. Every person has his own opinion. The Slavic world has gone through its ups and downs. Russia has gone through its own ups and downs. You know, it's composed of like 16 or 32 Slavic tribes, but eventually the nation of Rus came forth, and Kiev was the center of that nation. And that gives me reason to think that, you know, fundamentally we are one of the same nation. We are one of the same people. But as we developed, Ukraine was really close to a western border, and it developed in its own way. Certainly, it has a lot of identity, its language and culture. And Russia loves that. They feel that it's part of its own culture. Take the 19th century. There were a lot of people who said that Ukraine needs to be independent, needs to have its own path. Do they have that right to say so? Yeah, perhaps yes. That was part of the empire where, you know, there was some policy to introduce the Russian language or the Russian culture, to impose it on the Ukrainians. Well, you know, back then, we didn't have such a line in the passport as a national. Nationality. Ukrainians were no different whatsoever, and whatsoever from Russians. Ukraine joined the Russian Empire in 1645. There were three regions: Kiev, Chernigov, and the modern-day Zhytomyr. So three regions. So they've been part of the Russian Empire for a long time, and thanks to being part of the Russian Empire, got many new lands. We had the Russian-Turkish War. We had, World War One, World War Two. But then the Bolsheviks decided that all territories around Ukraine should belong to the newly established Republic of Ukraine. So, following World War II, the western regions were incorporated into it. And in 1954, Crimea was also incorporated into it, in violation of the legislation that was in place back then. So it was an illegitimate, illegal decision. What followed was a referendum by the Ukrainian people. I'm sure we'll Leave those times behind. Some people say that Ukraine should rather develop as an independent state. It's fine. If people think so, it's fine. You need to support it. It's counterproductive to go against the will of the people. But take the trends in the world. We're seeing a reverse trend. People of different identities, people of different cultures, of different languages are coming together. The same is happening in the US. The same is happening in North America. The same is happening in Europe. The same is happening in Asia. Everywhere. So we need to come to an understanding of what is good for both of us and what is counterproductive for both of us. Someone's tore us apart, but we need to come together.
Let's go to Мир now.
Thank you, Mr. Peskov. Буквально через несколько дней Евразийскому экономическому союзу исполняется 3 года, но наша интеграция стартовала в сложное время для России. В 14 году ее рухнули цены на нефть, и Запад стал на plummeted, and the West launched a sanctions war against Russia. Many think that this slow start of this integration process was due to Western sanctions imposed on Russia. This is why we were unable to present clear advantages of combining our product and labor markets. What do you think about that? What do you think are the biggest achievements for the Eurasian Economic Union? And if the U.S. imposes new sanctions on Russia, how will this affect the prospects of the EAU?
As for the Eurasian Economic Union, that's a shared achievement, a major one. You can always hear a lot of criticism, what the figures tell us is that we have taken the right decisions. We're moving the right way. Domestic turnover has been growing, the exports are up. You just have the figures, 29%, up 29%.
Значит, у нас, причем даже...
Even with those countries who just recently joined the Union, they also demonstrate some positive results. Like GDP in Russia is up 1.6, but the total GDP is up 1.8. The total GDP of the Eurasian Economic Union. That's a very good figure. We're seeing changes for the better in the structure of our trade turnover. Take Belarus. One third
of
their exports to the Eurasian Economic Union countries, that's machinery. One third is agricultural goods. Belarus now has the right to get 24 million of tons of oil and export it abroad and get the margin as revenue for their own budget, and that's billions of dollars. So we're moving the right way. There are some issues that are have been unresolved. There have been some exemptions related to electric energy and other energy sources. But we have a clear timeline year on year, a clear roadmap that details when we will reach full liberalization. We also have some a roadmap on the customs procedures and rules. Some negotiations are pretty slow. but I hope that we will soon introduce electronic declaration of goods that are transported through our territory so that we can register them and track their movement. We also need to introduce joint checkpoints, customs areas. I don't think it's bad when we have customs offices from Kazakhstan or Belarus and work for some time, and doesn't undermine the principle of sovereignty, just makes the operations of the customs service more transparent. And certainly e-procedures, electronic procedures, must be introduced.
Let's go to Rizan now. There's a question about the utilities sector, I guess. Let's talk about more practical issues for a moment. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Alexey Kachetkov, Rizan. Mr. Putin, good afternoon. I would like to start with a very short request, just a couple of sentences. We have a program in our region improving living conditions and landscaping programs. Urban areas. So please maintain funding for such programs. They are really necessary. And my question about the utilities sector. In recent years, many people have been complaining about growing tariffs, whereas the quality of services remains quite low. So my question to you is, what needs to be done in the utilities sector to avoid such complaints in the future? Thank you.
There's another question on utilities. I'll turn over to you, Ira. You'll have a chance.
Kaluga 24 website, Mr. Putin, despite all the objective positive developments in the utility sector, there's a big black hole. Certain utilities company, managing companies, they collect money from people, but they don't make payments to utilities companies, and then they go bankrupt and disappear. Even in Kaluga region, the authorities do their best to keep an eye on this problem, but the situation is really poor. At the local level, we are no longer able to deal with this issue. The federal government needs to get involved. Thank you very much. I know that you've made a decision to introduce direct payments from people to utility companies. This is just the first step in the right direction. But this entire sector is highly criminalized, and you need to set it in order.
That was another question on utilities.
Виктор Смирнов, корреспондент издания 47news.ru, новости Ленинградской области.
47news.ru website. In November and December, military officers living at military bases throughout the country received their utility bills. They're exorbitant. In St. Petersburg region, one family had to pay 50,000 rubles a month. This is because of a new managing company coming in. Military bases are often abandoned. They're not supplied properly. You're not aware of the situation. We can show you pictures. We can show you those bills. My question to you is, can you do something about this situation? This is just another company introduced by the Defense Ministry, and people have to pay 50,000 rubles in bills, in utility bills.
I do share your concern about military bases. We'll definitely need to focus on that. It's one of the most acute issues in terms of utility payments. Once the Defense Ministry quits, the transfer, the handover needs to take place in a balanced way. But overall, that's part of the utility issues nationwide. Your colleague said that despite a lot of positive trends, there's still a lot of gaps. And there was another journalist who brought up some issues. So what is my attitude to this? I don't feel that the situation is developing in a positive way. There are still more problems than problems that have been solved. Some of the decisions have been made, some changes did take place, but that's not enough. I think that both the regional and the federal authorities, the Ministry of Construction, and there are special departments and agencies that to deal with the utilities, they are underperforming. What is the root of the problem? Those management, property management companies, utility companies, they get those utility payments and also they get those property payments. What's the difference? Utility payments go to management companies, maintenance companies, gas bills, power bills, sewage. And housing bills, that's the bills that should pay everything that happens inside the building itself. So they first get the money for everything, and then they pay to their contractors, and they don't always pay in full and on time. And there's little control and oversight over it. What do we have to do? You know, those property management, those utility companies should not be allowed to get those payments. So they don't manipulate them. There are other schemes. They impose some surcharge fees. The customers disagree with that. And these utility companies will have to recalculate it, and they would also have to pay a fine, a 50% fine for the bill that was wrongly calculated. And we need to take that decision. So as I said, there are two types of payments, utility payments and housing payments. As for utility payments, we do have some federal regulation in place the past several years. Have seen a 4% freeze, but we've seen some violations. I got some data yesterday, and it's 8.8%. So why do we have 8.8% when we have a limit, a cap of 4%? But there's a different situation. Housing payments, there's no regulation, there's no cap on payments in this area. So we are seeing those payments going through the roof. So an average, it's 23%. And in some months, it's 30+% increase. So what do we do? We need to introduce caps. We need to introduce the same kind of regulation. We have to do it immediately. But again, we need to provide the right conditions for this area to develop. New construction projects should be introduced and existing ones should be maintained.
Let's continue. I see some people from China here, Russia and China. Hello, Mr. Putin. I represent Chinese International Radio and the China-Russia app. In March 2018, Russia will have a presidential election. Do you think the outcome, how will the outcome of this election impact Russia-China relations? Or do you think that our strategic partnership is above short-term political situations? Let's take a question from Xinhua as well. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. President. I represent the Xinhua news agency. My name is Luo Hai. As we know, Russia and China decided to align their initiatives of One Belt, One Road and the Eurasian Economic Union. Could you please comment on the results of this work after the last year? How would you assess the results and the prospects of developing relations between Russia and China? And my second question, the Communist Party of China has set the goal of developing new international relations, one future based on equality and mutually beneficial relations. What do you think about that? Is Russia ready to have cooperation with China in achieving this goal?
First of all, on the decisions taken by the Communist Party just recently, my assessment is very positive. And that fully corresponds or is very similar to what we offer as a development platform for Russia's role in the world. So first of all, that's economic cooperation. Chinese economy has been growing really fast, and that's been thanks to the decisions that have been made over the past 10 years. Yes. By the current president, by the current leader and his predecessors. China wants to be a stable country and they want to ensure development. And based on that development, they want to see their incomes of their people grow. China is a strategic partner for Russia. We have the growest trade turnover, more than 63 billion. It's been down due to the situation in the economy globally, but I'm sure that we will have even a better result very soon. As for the alignment of the One Belt, One Road initiative and the Eurasian Economic Union, it's fully compatible. So we would like to take part in the broader cooperation in Asia. There have been some progress made even today. Earlier I responded to a question on the Arctic. China has been really interested in the Northern Sea Route. Our ultimate goal is to provide for the movement from Asia to Europe and from Europe to Asia. Now, if we do that, it will be economically more efficient. And we would like to make sure that China makes use of those benefits. China is now part of some major projects in the Arctic. We just launched the first line of the first stretch of Yamal LNG project. So it will be 16.5 million tons. That's an annual output, and China is one of the major investors. And there's no coincidence, there's a reason for it. China is interested economically, and we will also cooperate on other projects. Pipeline gas supplies. We have another great project on high-speed transit. Well, that's what the Silk Route is all about. We do support this, this high transit link from China to Western Europe via Russia.
We'll
increase the speeds of transit of goods and service, of goods and people multiple times. We also have joint projects in aviation, in space exploration. So I'm sure we are moving the right way. We are fully determined to go that way. As for the election that will take place next year, I have full confidence that cooperation with China is beyond any political agenda. We will always remain strategic partners for a long period of time. NTV. Mr. Kondratiev, one of the veterans. Mr. Putin, our people talk a lot about your future time in office. What kind of team will you have for the next 6 years? Everyone's been talking about this. So will the existing government survive? Will all of those ministers still be in their places? Now, what is the will be the new agenda, what will be in the new blueprint?
As regards the current cabinet, on the whole, I believe they're doing a good job, even though there are certain issues, like I just mentioned, the utilities sector, for example. This is one problem that needs to be resolved, but there are many other issues as well that require attention. But on the whole, I would say the government has been performing quite well, and I would describe the results of its work as satisfactory. By the way, the fact that our economy is steadily growing is also a good indicator. It indicates that the government is doing a good job. Macroeconomic indicators are positive, and this lays the foundation for future development, of course. Otherwise, there would be no foreign direct investment, because all this comes as a result of a growing trust. They trust in the policies pursued by the Russian government. As regards the future, I hope you will not be offended, but it's premature to talk about this. We should discuss this after the election, even though, of course, I have some preliminary ideas. Wait a second. Just a second, please. Just a second. There was a question next to Ukraine. There was a question from Poland. Let's take a question from Poland.
Andrzej Zocha, Polish TV. Last year I asked you about the remains of the Polish aircraft, from that crash. When will the remains of the aircraft will be returned to Poland? And Poland, my second question, Poland expects a new report on the investigation into that crash. There have been some reports that there were some explosions on board the airplane, and the defense minister says there's been some evidence, and he's got his own commission, and he said that some of your operatives provoked that crash.
Listen, we are tired of this bluff. It's just nonsense. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Okay, let me remind you, I was the prime minister at the time, and I had nothing to do with the foreign policy, security agencies, and all that. Please remember about that. Then, if there was an explosion on board, where did they take off? In Moscow? No, in Warsaw. So, was it some Russian agents who planted the bomb? You should look among your own people then. And number three, there has been no explosion on board, and both Russian and Polish experts have looked into this. They studied carefully everything that happened inside the cabin. when there was somebody who went into the cockpit, and the pilot said, there is no way we can land there. And this guy said, no, I won't tell him that we can't land. Go ahead and land. It is a disaster, and we were mourning together with you, and now that you're trying to speculate about this incident, this tragedy. And the situation with the debris of the crash is the same. Don't invent anything. If there is a problem, if there is a tragedy, we should treat it as a tragedy. We shouldn't speculate about this. We shouldn't politicize the issue. Why are you doing that? Do you want to complicate relations between Russia and Poland further? Why? What for? Just to score some political points for some political forces inside Poland? I think Russia-Poland relations are more important than short-term politics, different political forces fighting in Poland using Russia as a policy issue. You should close this chapter. Go to open a new chapter. Look at the interests of the Polish nation and the people of Poland. You holding on to these problems and undermining Russia-Poland relations won't serve your interests. Look at how many jobs you lost and how much money you lost because of those sanctions. We don't need anything from Poland. We just want to develop our relations with Poland, and I hope that this approach, the same approach, will prevail in Poland as well.
Interfax, Russia's news agency Interfax.
Середина центрального сектора.
Mr. Putin, Ksenia Golovanova from Interfax. I have a question on Syria. Mr. Peskov, I'll try to be short. There have been multiple contacts on the Syria crisis that you've had in the past days. What are the main barriers, what are the main pitfalls on the path to resolution and reconciliation? Who should be in charge, or who can take up the burden of restoring the infrastructure? You said that ISIS in Syria has been defeated. Why do we need Russian bases there? Do you have a concern that our Western counterparts could interpret this move as solely as a tool to support Assad in power? So you went to Syria. How was it? How did it happen? Did the Syrian army, provide security, or perhaps the Russian air force? And when will you finalize the withdrawal of Russian troops from Syria? Magomed Magomedov from the Dagestan News Agency. 1999, you came to Dagestan and you defeated, countered the incursion of international terrorists into Dagestan. The same happened now in Syria. I don't think that terrorism has been dismantled completely. You are one of the leaders who are fighting against terrorism. The US has not been giving us the right kind of examples. How can we find and destroy the puppeteers of ISIS or any other terrorist groups? Perhaps we'll have another terrorist group in the future. Well, it's good to be Andrei Kolesnik, Mr. Kolesnikov or Mr. Brilov, but I'm not as popular. I work on international affairs and education. I came over to the Khmeimim air base. Well, you know, what's your name? Arslan Khazanov. It's Uchitelskaya Gazeta, teacher's newspaper. So I was the first Russian who came to the Khmeimim air base by foot.
Where did you come from? By foot.
So I went from Latakia to Tartus and Homs.
It's a dangerous route. Where do you come from? Dagestan?
Well, I was born in the Chechen Republic.
Only Chechens can travel on foot in Syria.
So I came to Homs and I went to their refugee camp. There are so many orphans. I then went to Istanbul, and you have barefooted Syrian children running around begging for money. So back to those refugee camps. You have Syrians there. We don't have any education programs right now. You know, I was witness to it. We do get some humanitarian aid, but we don't know what happens to those children in 10 to 15 years. Now, following your announcements of the defeat of ISIS in Syria, should we think perhaps about massive humanitarian assistance? The Russian center in Damascus was shut down. And just like your press secretary, I graduated from the Institute of Asian and Oriental Studies. So if you instruct me, if you give me the mandate, I'm ready to go there and chair that center.
I think we already have a person from Chechnya who is doing this kind of work there, and his name is Kadyrov, and he helps evacuate children from there. But you are right, actually, and this is no joke. Please sit down. You're totally right. This is a problem. And it is Turkey that suffers the most from this problem, because the bulk of refugees go to Turkey. Turkey has biggest refugee camps, but not just Turkey, Jordan as well. We are aware of problems with migrants that Europe is facing today. So we certainly need to address this problem, and I don't think Syria can resolve this issue on its own. All good people around the world should realize that unless we join our forces in addressing this issue, this problem will end up on their door, on their porch as well. Unless these children are properly educated and get proper upbringing, you know, where terrorists recruit their new members among poorly educated people and the poor people in general. This unfair treatment is the biggest source of new recruits for terrorists, and we certainly need to do something about that, but Syria cannot resolve this problem on its own, and Russia cannot resolve this problem on its own, so we are ready to contribute, but we can only be part of international effort. And thank you for your question and your initiative. This is no joke. I don't rule this out. You might do some work there, just like, for example, our MPs from the Northern Caucasus work there, our military police officers. It was my initiative. I suggested that we send people from Northern Caucasus to Syria as military police, because most of them are Sunnis, and local population, they're also Sunnis, and they trust them. And local administration trusts them, because these are Russian personnel, and they're Sunnis, and it's quite good, and they're very disciplined, very good guys, very disciplined. They were aware of this responsibility, and they did their job very well, representing Russia's interests there. But this part is also very important. It's very important for our specialists like yourself to be involved there. Now, as far as my trip to the Khmeimim air base is concerned, it was obvious to me that I have to go there. The only question was whether conditions were right for such a trip. We had to finish fighting those terrorist groups. Now, finally, we have the situation which allowed for such a trip. Most of those terrorist groups have been defeated. Security issues were taken care of by our troops on the ground. Well, specialists know that the most dangerous part of this of such trips is when you land and when you take off. That's where they can hit you with the man pad missile. But I saw those pilots when they were actually below our plane when we landed, and I could but those military aircraft, the temperature on their nozzles is much higher than on, they basically protected our plane from missiles, they shielded us from any potential attack, and I'm grateful to them for doing this, even though I think this may have been unnecessary, but still they protected us in such a way. They did this flying even lower than we did before landing. But to resolve this issue entirely in Syria and fighting terrorism in general, you need to increase the welfare of people. You need to address historical injustices in the Middle East and throughout the world, generally speaking. In Syria and in other places, it is important for all the parties involved, for all the global players, to have no desire, no temptation to take advantage of some terrorist, quasi-terrorist and radical extremist groups to achieve their short-term political goals. For example, when they created Al-Qaeda to fight the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, eventually Al-Qaeda attacked New York on 9/11. And now we can see our fighter pilots, our drones can tell that those terrorists are escaping to Iraq, to the territories controlled by our U.S. partners, and they don't hit them. Why? Because they want to use them later to fight ISIS. This is a very easy way, but it's extremely dangerous, including those who do this.
Alexander Gamov. Комсомольская правда. My name is Alexander Gamov. So I think healthcare is the most important issue. We know there's a lot of focus on from the government and from the president. No one argues that the past 15 years have seen major headway. We do have hospitals and medical centers, even in Russia's remote areas. I'm sure you have this information. I'm sure you get reports on this. But at the same time, the so-called streamlining, or the optimization, as it's known here in Russia, was taking place. We saw a consolidation of hospitals and, you know, smaller hospital units were shut down. Well, you might do this when you have a good road network, when you use helicopters to transport patients, but when you don't have roads, when you don't have helicopters, it's a complete disaster. So people have to go to other cities and to towns to get medical assistance. Please be brief. And Komsomolskaya Pravda, our newspaper, has a report on Lyudmila Yanina and her colleagues from Orenburg. Orenburg has two cancer centers, but the Orenburg region is very, very big, and people have to go to Orenburg, to the capital city of the region, have to go to there through snowstorms, through blizzards. Do you feel that this kind of streamlining has been done at a heavy cost, social cost? And you used to come to the office of Komsomolskaya newspaper, and I invite you to come over once again. And perhaps Mr. Peskov will have some leverage over you.
Thank you for the invitation. Is it okay if I answer the question first? If you all keep asking questions and I can't answer them, it doesn't make any sense. Okay, on healthcare, I did say at the very beginning of this event today that this is one of our top priorities for the future. Okay, go ahead and ask your question.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.